Welcome to Reconsider. I'm Bill Hartman. This is the podcast to challenge you to ask better questions, to look beyond traditional models of thinking, and arrive at better health and fitness solutions.
You had mentioned talking about full range of motion. I don't really remember what. In what context you were?
Well, we need to reconsider range of motion as a concept, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So we're reconsidering full range of motion as the
concept of full range of motion. Really, it creates a lot of misrepresentation. Therefore, there's misdiagnosis, and therefore there are interventions that are inappropriate, and then it's very misleading. And what we can talk about a couple of maybe specific cases that will make sense to people, but generally speaking, I think that when you look at some of the models that are used, that we would use like a cadaver model or just the skeleton in and of itself, and without looking at all the other stuff that's connected, right? Then I think that the representation of what joint range of motion is, and then how much you actually have, it's misleading. So, you know, we talk about, I got to grab something. We talk about joint range of motion because we're helping. We talk about joint range of motion because we're looking at the bones, right?
Yeah.
And we've always been able to sort of look at the bones separately. So X-rays are a little misleading because all we tend to see is like the bones and some cloudy stuff. And then we don't get the representation of the way that the fluid within the joint behaves, because there's points in time where if you compress the synovial fluid in the joint no longer exists. It's literally gone. Take like a bowed leg. Like, why would a leg bow? If I twist a leg far enough in one direction, I compress the synovial fluid and it becomes a solid, and then that joint disappears and all you have is one long piece of extremity. And then that's why the bow would occur, because there's downward pressure medially, and then there's an expansion that occurs laterally in the extremity. Well, the only way that that can occur is if the knee is no longer a joint. So the joint just disappears. And so we have to appreciate how that happens a lot in many of these circumstances, because if every joint moves on a helical axis, which it does, as far as we know, then there's all these bends and twists that occur that really aren't relative motions between bones anymore. And so when people are talking about, I'm going to pick on bodybuilders because it's kind of easy in this circumstance where you grab any clip off of social media and a bodybuilder is talking about, oh, you got to use full range of motion. It's like, there's not a single exercise that a bodybuilder would use that has a full excursion of what we would consider normal ranges of motion.
Nor would they really want to.
So think about this. If you could, the degree of recruitment that would be involved would be so low that there would be an insufficient stimulus for hypertrophy, right?
Yeah. So like just thinking about for a squat, for example, if you're going from an expanded to a compressed to an expanded state, you want to stay as close to the compressed state as possible to keep tension in the muscle.
Yeah. Exactly. I want the excursion of the activity to put the stress on the muscle fiber itself. If you have access to joint ranges of motion that would be considered relative,
right,
that the force output would be exceptionally low. So do you really want full extension? No. You want to bend stuff so you actually put stress in the place that you want it for the adaptation to occur. So if I'm trying to increase force production, we know that if I have relative motion, my force production goes down because I have a dampening effect that would take place. So I need high forces. So that's why bigger and bigger weights make bigger and bigger muscles, improves your force production. I have to have less and less relative motion available. So you're using exhalation strategies. You're trying to intentionally limit ranges of motion. So when you hear a bodybuilder say, well, you've got to move through a full range of motion, that's horse hockey. That's horse hockey. What you need is enough stress on the tissues involved. And that's what you're doing. And that's why you're bending things. So when people are demonstrating their amazing abilities to move through these joint excursions under load, right? And they're holding their breath and their faces are red and they're saying, this is how you get better range of motion. Like, no, It's not. That's how you stress the tissues. Yes.
Yeah.
Will it result in improved, comfortable, easy relative motion? I would challenge that conclusion. I don't think it does. I don't think it does. Relative motion doesn't really feel like anything. It's very easy because there's no tension on the connective tissues because that's where your sensation is going to be coming from. If you're using an exhalation strategy, you are intentionally limiting relative motions. And right. So again, that's why we have to sort of reconsider what we're actually calling full ranges of motion, because just bending a knee, like I can bend a knee against the mechanics. I can get your heel to your butt in multiple ways, and they're not the same. So let's use a knee strategy as an example. Okay. So I can take like in supine. So we do like a heel to butt measurement for knee excursion. Okay. If I twist the tibia into ER, I can bend the knee and bring the heel to the butt. Okay. Now that would not necessarily be the ideal excursion of the knee because there should be an element of internal rotation of the tibia in a normal knee bend as you would absorb force from the ground. Okay. But if I'm using just strictly a heel to butt representation as full knee excursion, and I say, oh, you have full knee range of motion, but you can't acquire the internally rotated position of the tibia when you do need it, but you can bend the knee, I've just compromised your ability to produce force through that knee. And then you wonder why you get a recurrent ACL.
Right.
Because they're just worried about knee bend, knee straightening. And that's the old straight plane concept of thinking. Instead of appreciating the fact that I have these rotations that have to occur under normal circumstances, so I get directionality associated with force production and then the ability to absorb energy into tissues and then reapply that energy into the ground. So if I have a misrepresentation of what I understand as full excursion or full knee range of motion under that circumstance, and I acquire it the wrong way, and I make my assumption that this is now a normal knee, and it is not, and then I send somebody out to produce high levels of force, this is your recurrent stuff, right? Why is the number one predictor of injury previous injury? Well, because if I don't restore the mechanics that would have protected you from the first incident, and you are the same person that you were before.
Right.
What should I expect?
Yeah, I like to tell people, like, the strategy that got you into this is not going to get you out. So you're not just going to hammer on the same running mechanics that you used to use and hope that you're just going to get more fit and that's going to fix it. It's like, no, something was broken to begin with. We need to address the strategy. We need to address the mechanical,
right.
You know, technical right. aspect of
yeah.
it. Yeah. So go ahead. I was going to say, like, trying to take a step back so that everyone can sort of help to understand what the traditional representation of range of motion is. And you had kind of talked about it a little bit, but it's like the cardinal planes, like the frontal, sagittal, transverse. It's right. looking at the body as like levers and pulleys and joints that kind of move like a machine. So hinges right. and levers and
right.
Ball and socket type of things.
Right.
And then you throw a goniometer on someone's joint and you measure it in a, right. like a position on a table, how much it can internally and externally rotate and abduct and adduct and all of these things right. that confine you within those cardinal planes and that type of thinking. And what you're saying yes. is that range of motion really is not that.
It is not. It is
okay.
not. Let's move up to the hip for an example. Okay.
Yeah.
So traditional hip flexion would be your sagittal plane bending of your hip. Okay. Now, so let's do this in two different ways and get the same outcome because you're going to measure it in a two-dimensional representation with your goniometer. Okay. So I take your hip and I bend it, right? So we're doing a table test. So we're measuring in reference to the table. But yeah. I'm taking this human. I'm going to bend the knee and I'm going to bend the hip and I'm going to do a traditional hip flexion test. Okay. As I move the femur past the vertical of where 90 degrees would be, there's two ways that I can get that femur closer to the rib cage. I could, I can create an internally rotated representation of the spine, which will be a spine that's actually turning away from me as I'm moving the femur closer to the axial skeleton, or I could actually be moving it towards midline where the spine is actually turning towards me. Okay. The measurement at the hip in two dimensions with a goniometer could be exactly the same, but there was two different strategies to arrive there, but they're not the same. And so again, force production would be different. The ability to absorb energy would be different. This is why we have to look at this. We have to account for the fact that we've got a series of turns that are taking place as we are constraining this movement into what appears to be an arc of motion that does not exist.
Yeah. And that's, so this is sort of related, but I was, made me think of it like people's obsession now with like force plates and using them to test. They might have two athletes who, when they measure their hip flexion on the table, they have the same hip flexion, but one can absorb and produce force in a different way. That's really telling of like which person actually has a true bend to their knee and hip versus what person is orienting and sort of folding into that position.
Correct. We have to, and the nice thing about running a chessboard is that it does account for these strategies. So we can actually identify. So when I say somebody bends a hip past a certain point, I have to have other measures that confirm the strategy that they're using to actually bend the hip into that position. Because if I don't understand that, and I just take it at face value that, okay, so-and-so can bend their hip to 120 degrees on the table, they have normal hip range of motion. It's like, really? How did you acquire that? And how did you account for the spinal orientation? Because again, if I'm using a substitution for the hip at the spine, now you wonder why you have a spinal pathology that's going to come back and to bite you. It's like when you're measuring a hip on somebody that has back pain and you're not accounting for the spinal strategy, how do you even know what to do? Do you just go to the back pain protocol and you pull out your six different exercises that you had pre-printed out and you go, here's what we do for people with back pain. And then you wonder why you're not successful.
And what Bill means by, so spinal strategy, I think we're talking about things that people might not know what we mean. So the Bill's talking about like a compensatory strategy where if someone's laying on a table and they're being taken up into hip flexion, they roll away from the measuring leg with their spine to create space.
Or so toward. It's like, you can go either way. Like you
toward,
can, like,
you'll roll again, away and then towards and then away. Yeah.
This is why we get into constraints and structure and such like that, because there's going to be certain times where a certain strategy is going to be more in play, but you got to be able to identify that. And if you don't understand how to run the chessboard, then you'll be lost. You'll be successful in some cases. And then in other cases, you're going to wonder why, well, I did the same thing that I did before last time I saw this. You don't have the same constraints and you don't have the same scenario. Sure. Even though it might look like that through your straight plane measures, this is the limitation of that type of thinking. It's like I'm okay with being able to speak that language, but we got to look at this differently. We have to reconsider what we're considering ranges of motion, right?
Right.
When we look at the averages, right? This is what we have in a textbook. We have a textbook average, but we have the way that those numbers are acquired, there are so many outliers. And then they took an average and they said, well, this is, they called it norms. And then so people make the assumption that you have normal range of motion. That doesn't happen ever. Everybody has idiosyncratic measures. They will approach some average if we get enough people together. But the reality is, it's like if we don't consider the idiosyncratic measures of how these people actually move through space. And then this is why I constructed the archetype. So we have an understanding of those foundations. Now we make better decisions. Our interventions get much more targeted because we can understand what this person is actually using as a strategy, what is missing from that strategy that would be more protective, the ability to absorb and transfer energy, the ability to produce force in a very specific direction, right? And now we can, like I said, we just make better decisions. So our outcomes get better. Like we're always going to be playing probability because, again, we're using models because we just don't know. There's unknowns and there's unknown unknowns. There always will be that way, right? The idea is to get better and better and better and to manage the probabilities with much more effective interventions.
Yeah. And I think I want to kind of go back to the spinal compensatory thing. The lumbar, the main reason why those strategies become so used, I guess, is because of the lumbar and cervical spine being having large degrees of freedom to allow for the path of least resistance to just be to bend there. Is that the reason why?
Not necessarily, because what's going to happen under those circumstances. So when you think about how a pelvis orients anteriorly, so under that circumstance, and this is why I grabbed my little thingy. So I grabbed one of these. So in that circumstance, when you have anterior orientation, what you're going to have, so let's just say the lumbar spine has five segments in it. Okay. So the perspective would be that we have five segments that would move with relative motion. The greater the degree of anterior orientation, the more reduced the relative motion will be between those segments. So the lumbar spine starts to behaving like a solid. And so what it does is it starts to do things like this. So I take the spine. So this is my side view, the old school sagittal view of the spine. And so as it would be bending into anterior orientation, it would look like that. Okay. But what I can do, so if I take a hip and I bend it and I roll back on the table, I can bend the spine in the opposing direction. Okay. But under that circumstance, when I have that much anterior orientation, I've actually have a reduced relative motion between the femur and the pelvis. So when I try to move the femur, what I'm actually doing is I'm going to bend the spine and it's going to turn either towards me or away from me, depending on how much orientation that I have. So if I can orient it and I can bend it into what would look like a traditional flexion with relative motion, it's not relative motion, it's just bending the spine into that forward direction, it will roll towards me as I twist the hip into ER. Right. So I have to, again, this is why I have to understand, it's like, what am I actually using to produce that movement? Because the assumption is, the way that we're taught in school, is that if I'm intending to measure a hip, I'm measuring a hip. When the reality is like, if my intention is to measure the hip, but the spine's moving, I get a totally different measure. And that measurement is not a representation of how well the hip moves. Well, if it's not measuring the hip and I'm thinking it's a hip strategy, I give the wrong activity to that person to solve the problem, because I'm not actually solving the problem. I'm solving the wrong problem, because what I got is I got an oriented pelvis that's making the spine move. It's not the reason that the hip is not moving. That's a totally different reason. And again, this is why we experience failures, is because we can't understand all of this. So we have to use the representative model, but it makes better decisions possible.
Right. Okay. So we've talked about like the traditional perspective of what range of motion is, a bit. We've talked about like why ranges of motion are kind of dirty measures are from compensatory strategies that mostly happen through orientations and spinal bends and movements. Mm-hmm. Let's tell people now, like, what we're asking them to reconsider. What's a better way to think about what range of motion is, what it comes from, what it means?
Well, okay. So look at it from the perspective of shape change, not levers and pulleys, as you were saying. Levers, pulleys, hinges, saddles, etc. Right? That kind of thinking comes from the representation. So we have mechanical models of all of these levers. So there's like class ones, twos, and threes, right? And so we understand those. And then depending on what you use as your point of reference. So if I use like, a dry cadaver that I can dissect down, I can make it look like levers and pulleys, because I've taken the water out of the equation, right? That one of the things that we want to understand is like, we don't have a structure of a skeleton and then we hang stuff on it. The skeleton is actually floating inside of you, like you are, for lack of a better term, you're a worm with a little bit more structure to it. Right? That's basically how you move. We have stiffer elements and the stiffness changes at different times, which is why you can get either a sprained ankle or an avulsion fracture. It's like, what's stiffest at that point in time under the circumstance of tissues being loaded? Because that fluctuates. So even the stiffest parts don't always seem like the stiffest parts. It depends on what, very contextual. So ranges of motion are idiosyncratic by structure. It depends on applications of force and energy and time and position and context. So it's variable in that respect. If we create a specific context, that's where these averages come from.
Right.
And again, we have to consider, like, we're always influencing it by context, right? We can use the averages as comparators to help us make decisions. But what we don't want to do is pigeonhole everybody into, this is what insurance companies do, is they have to have a framework to allow them to make decisions. And so they use the textbook averages for comparisons. And they say, well, if you're not moving towards this number in therapy, then we can't pay for it because it doesn't look like you're making much progress. When the reality is, it's like, I don't necessarily need that excursion to alleviate symptoms, allow somebody to perform in a certain right. way.
Or if you're a wide individual, you may never get that level of shoulder flexion ever.
Correct. Because it doesn't exist in your world.
And you trying to jam someone into a position overhead is just going to create a cervical spine.
It's like, how are you getting there?
Cervical spine compensatory strategy.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. We have to take into consideration how this stuff is occurring.
So a better way to do it would be if we were to take 10,000 of the widest wides that we could find and 10,000 of the narrowest narrows we could find and then measure all of them, we would probably have two different sets of averages that were pretty far away from each other.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. We would. Absolutely.
And that's kind of what you're saying, is that, like, the idiosyncratic element Bill's talking about is like every person. So I'm a narrower individual. So I have narrower helical angles in which I can move on. So correct. If I'm moving on those narrow angles, that's where I would expect to have my relative motions to be.
Your greatest relative motion would occur directly on those. Yes.
When I move off of those angles is when I'm going to have to orient and I'm going to have to stiffen things more, correct. Create this sort of correct. Tension in order
you've
to
immediately access. Reduced. You've immediately reduced the amount of relative movement between segments by moving off the helical angle. Doesn't make it bad, doesn't make it good. It's just what it is. Then context determines what would be the best course of action.
Right.
And again, it's like, what outcome are you desiring? Is it a performance-related outcome or is it a health-related outcome? Because they're not necessarily the same, which is why there's a continuum.
We didn't plug the network once. Shame on us. It's okay.
Hey. Join the Unified Health and Performance Network.
Hey, Davey and Long and the other five people that watched this to the end. Tell your friends. Tell everyone you know to sign up.
Should we do a commercial?
Network. No.
No?
I don't want to do a commercial.
That was good.
Yeah.
That was good. I was a little passionate. Was it too much?
No, I think that's what people want to see you talking more than me anyways. So that would be good.
But see, you're the translator. I love what Bill is actually saying.
Yeah, well, because it's like, people still aren't going to get what you're saying. It's like the ranges of motion exciting. That you're measuring aren't. They're just rolling around and flopping around on the table.
You just have to hear it a bunch of times. That's all.
I'm always trying to think of like better analogies to give than the ones we currently give. I like today how we talked about the arm, the extremity action of the arm for the rib and the bellows. Like those are better analogies to use. I think that I picture, like, I don't know. It's like shoulder and hip sockets and eye sockets, like being these, like, they're like cones of light coming out of each of them. And those cones of light are like the area in which you can move within for each individual structure.
Yes.
I think that's a good way to sort of think about it. And it's only on those narrower or wider angles.
Yeah. Okay. So if you want to expand it, you got to actually turn the sockets.
Yeah.
And that's what expands the range of motion. Yeah.
You're shining the lights at different spots and then you're moving through space. So literally the lights are moving. You're trying to find you're trying to find the escaping prisoners in the yard.
Yeah. It's like this imagined 180 degrees of shoulder flexion is bunk, because if you didn't reorient if you couldn't reorient the glenoid, guess what? You got 60 degrees tops.
Right. And then you have dead spaces where the lights can never converge. Like the cones can never.
That's why you don't ever whack your knuckles together behind your back.
Yeah. So if anyone's still watching, like you try to take your arms and cross them over and then look down.
There's a space. You can't go there.
There will always be a space there unless I break your sternum. Maybe if I broke your sternum in half, you could close that, but then you would just have a break in the constraint.
That doesn't seem necessary.
Bill and I got other stuff to do. So see you later, losers.